weapons waving, Confederate flags or swastikas. Yesterday, over 281,000 new cases of coronavirus were reported in the United States. Over 3.1 million new cases were counted worldwide yesterday, along with 11,000 additional deaths. Coronavirus has now infected over 76 million and killed over 900,000 people in the United States. Globally, there have been over 395 million confirmed cases and over 5.7 million deaths. And in weather today, in Washington, D.C., it is 41 degrees and cloudy. In New York City, 35 degrees and cloudy. From WPFW in Washington and WBAI in New York, I'm Sue Goodwin.
The time now is 1 p.m. Stay tuned for Leonard Lopate at Large coming up here on WBAI New York 99.5 FM and WBAI.org online. Stay tuned.
Welcome to Leonard Lopate at Large. I'm Leonard Lopate. There have been reports in recent months of sexual abuse, kidnapping, and torture of leading nonviolent activists inside Western Sahara by Moroccan security forces, and Freedom House has recently ranked the situation there as second only to Syria out of some 210 nations in terms of the suppression of political rights. In an updated version of Western Sahara, War, Nationalism, and Conflict and Resolution, a book that was originally published in 2010, Stephen Zunis, a leading scholar of the Middle East and North Africa, argues that what's at stake in Western Sahara is not just the fate of one small country, but the entire post-World War II international legal order that prohibits the invasion and annexation of one country by another. It's published by Syracuse University Press and brings Professor Stephen Zunis to our show now. Welcome.
Thank you for having me.
The media are full of stories about possible Russian invasion of Ukraine, and yet this story has gone generally unnoticed. Why do you think that is?
Well, the easiest answer is that Morocco is a strategic ally of the United States. And as we have seen, whether it be in regard of human rights, international law, or any number of other things, the United States and much of the mainstream media seems to have a double standard. They will certainly publicize and sometimes even exaggerate violations of human rights and international legal standards by governments we don't like, but ignore and downplay those by governments that are considered allies.
But haven't the United Nations Security Council, the UN General Assembly, and the International Court of Justice all gone on record asserting the right of the indigenous Sahrawi people of self-determination, the people that we're discussing here in Western Africa?
Oh, they're very much so. This is the it is Africa's last colony. It is a country that about the size of Colorado, just south of Morocco on the Atlantic coast, that was scheduled to become independent from Spain in 1976. But just prior to it, Moroccan forces with U.S. support ended up taking over most of the country. And despite calls by various UN bodies and the World Court that the people be allowed an act of self-determination, the Moroccans have refused. Instead, the U.S. is backing a rather dubious Moroccan proposal that they be granted some limited autonomy under Moroccan sovereignty. But international law is very clear that if you are a non-self-governing territory, that is a colony, you have the right to self-determination. The right of self-determination includes the option of independence, which the Moroccans have categorically ruled out. So, you know, this is a and the U.S. is very much an international outlier in this, in the sense that the U.S. is currently the only country in the world that has formally recognized Morocco's annexation of the territory. Even some of Morocco's allies, like France, you know, they may provide arms and aid to Morocco. They may, block the United Nations from enforcing its resolutions. That's been the policy of previous U.S. administrations. But Trump, in his final weeks, decided to actually outright recognize the annexation, and Biden, to the surprise of many, has refused to reverse it.
Western Sahara, which is formerly known as Sahrawi Arab Democratic Republic, SADR, has been recognized over the years by 84 countries and a full member state of the African Union. Why has the United States been the only holdout through both Democratic and Republican administrations?
Well, I mean, it is quite controversial, as you might imagine. It has raised a lot of objections from African states, as you might imagine, because we have effectively recognized the takeover of one African country by another, and the
after they were freed from Western colonial rule.
Right.
This is African after Spain gave it up.
Right. The charter of the Organization for African Unity and later the African Union is quite clear that even in the most arbitrary of boundaries, that no state can change them unilaterally. This is also enshrined in the United Nations Charter as well. But the U.S. is obviously the African countries are objecting. When Trump made this support for the takeover official, there was a huge outcry from Congress, ranging on to prominent liberal Democrats like Patrick Leahy, to conservative Republicans like James Inhofe, former State Department officials, and including former Secretary of State James Baker, who was the UN Secretary General Special Envoy to Western Sahara for nearly a decade, along with Christopher Ross and other top State Department people, also criticized the decision and have tried to press Biden to reverse it. But even though he has reversed a number of Trump's more controversial and pestuous foreign policy decisions, he's apparently holding firm on this one.
And we'll get to how that plays in light of what's going on with Ukraine. But to stay with the Sahrawis, the Sahrawi nationalist movement, the Polisario Front, fought for the territory's independence against Morocco and Mauritania. Don't they have a distinct history, dialect, culture? Are they Berbers?
Oh, they are. They speak Arabic. They're of mixed Arab and Berber ancestry. They are Sunni Muslims, and so in that sense, they have commonalities with most Moroccans. But they also have a distinct dialect, distinct dress, distinct cuisine, distinct history. They've never really been part of Morocco, despite the Moroccan claims to the contrary. They're nomadic people. They have never had a sultan or imam, and as a result, they like being free. They don't want to be part of a centralized autocratic monarchy. They also practice a relatively liberal interpretation of Islam. For example, they believe it's between the individual and God. It's not for the state to impose anything. For example, women have equal rights to inheritance and divorce. They keep their maiden names. In fact, because Moroccans see Sahrawi women as uppity, they have been targeted for sexual abuse and torture in prisons and the like. Yeah, the we're talking about a moderate, secular, somewhat leftist nationalist movement. And again, that's and so it's ironic when the United States goes around, saying, oh, we support democracy, we support women's rights, we support self-determination in the Arab world, that we are supporting this this really oppressive monarchy and its attacks against the a nation that wants to be a free republic.
It's mainly desert flatlands, one of the most sparsely populated territories in the world, with an estimated 500,000 people, despite its huge territory. What makes it so valuable to Morocco? Why does Morocco want to give them the independence?
Well, the initial takeover in 1975 may have been more of a political move. The king, Hassan II, had been subjected to two almost successful military coups in the preceding years. He was not very popular. This is the time when more left-leaning Arab nationalist movements, especially within the militaries, you know, had toppled monarchies in Egypt, in Iraq, in Libya, and it appeared that Morocco might be next. And I think his idea was that to get a nationalist card, to get people to rally around the flag, he would try to seize this desert area to the south of the country. I would also keep the army as far away from the capital as possible. So I think it was more for nationalist reasons. The U.S., under Secretary of State Henry Kissinger, supported the move because the Polisario was seen as a leftist movement. In Kissinger's word, we did not want another Angola in the North Atlantic. We pressured Spain to distracted by the imminent death of the dictator Francisco Franco, to not get involved, essentially to allow the Moroccans to move in like that. But subsequently, though, this territory's rich natural resources, which I think have kept the Moroccans there, especially since a lot of the generals who are overseeing the occupation, you know, have their hands in the lucrative resources there, particularly phosphates. Western Sahara is one of the world's largest producers of this important mineral that's used in fertilizers around the world. Also, it has some of the richest fishing grounds in the world. And so, you know, not only does this would this allow Morocco would allow an independent Western Sahara to be a viable state economically, it would be actually one of the better off countries in Africa in terms of per capita income, but it also is something that gets the Moroccans to want to hold on to the territory and basically steal those riches themselves.
Maps of North Africa from the United Nations, National Geographic, Rand McNally, and elsewhere depict the nation of Western Sahara as wedged between Morocco and Mauritania on the Atlantic coast. But don't U.S. government maps depict it as part of Morocco with nothing delineating the two?
Oh, yeah. It's really striking when you look at this. In fact, when the Trump administration recognized Western Sahara, there was a big to-do. The U.S. ambassador unveiled a new map and actually signed it where the old border used to be. But now, you know, you look at maps from the State Department, from the CIA, even NASA. You know, all government agencies show it as a one country. If you look at State Department reports. On various countries, used to have Western Sahara as a separate entity. Now it is within its reports involving Morocco. So again, the United States is really an outlier on this. And again, it's particularly ironic because with the growing crisis around Ukraine, the Biden administration has stressed this idea: no country can unilaterally change its borders. It is wrong for a country to expand its borders by force. And this is in reference, of course, to the Russian takeover of Crimea in 2014, its threats to have similar moves in eastern Ukraine. But the United States is in a weird position to be taking leadership on this. Again, given we're the only country that has formally recognizes Western Sahara as part of Morocco, which again is very much an illegal takeover by force, a unilateral shift of international boundaries, the very bedrock international legal principles we claim to be defending when it comes to Ukraine.
Well, what reasons did President Trump give when he formally recognized Moroccan sovereignty over this occupied territory, becoming the first and only member of the international community to do so?
We basically repeated the Moroccan line that Western Sahara was also always part of Morocco, which is not true. There were some tribal groups in that area who back in the 19th century pledged fealty to the Moroccan Sultan, but the International Court of Justice ruled that does not concentrate sovereignty, that it does not trump the right of self-determination. But Donald Trump basically repeated the Moroccan line, But it also happened to take place right at the same time that Morocco recognized Israel. And it was so yeah it was apparently a quid pro quo of some sorts that Morocco agreed they'd recognize Israel if the United States recognized their control of Western Sahara, and so it was a way of Trump to say, hey, look, this is the Abraham Accords, you're bringing peace to the Middle East, and look how great this is. And indeed, right now there's a big bipartisan bill in Congress touting the Moroccan recognition of Israel, along with two small monarchies in the Gulf, and seems to be reinforcing this. And it's a way, I think, of putting pressure on Biden not to reverse Trump's decision, because if the United States rescinded its recognition of Western Sahara, there's fear that Morocco would rescind its a recognition of Israel, and then Biden would get blamed for undermining Israel's security and, you know, undermining Middle East peace and all that kind of stuff. Now, of course, in reality, of course, the Abraham Accords don't really mean much. These are countries that have never been at war with Israel. They're many, many miles away from Israel. Doesn't address the Palestinian question, which, of course, is the key issue. And Morocco has been on very friendly terms with Israel for decades. This is not like this is a big shift in formal recognition. But there is, but yeah, I think this might be part of the political equation. I mean, it should be noted, though, that some of Israel's biggest supporters in Congress, including Elliot Engel, who until recently was the head of the House Foreign Relations Committee, condemned the agreement that had which recognized the Moroccan takeover of Western Sahara. James Inhofe, who's a fanatical supporter of Israel and the occupation of Palestinian land, also was very critical of the accord. So it really isn't necessarily a thing that, well, if you support Israel, therefore you should support the Moroccan occupation. But perhaps that isn't one issue that may be making Biden reluctant to reverse Trump's actions.
You're listening to Leonard Lopate at Large on WBAI New York 99.5 FM and streaming live at WBAI.org. My guest is Stephen Zunes, Z-U-N-E-S. I hope I'm pronouncing it correctly.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. A professor of politics at the University of San Francisco, co-author of Western Sahara War, Nationalism and Conflict Irresolution. This book is an updated version of something you co-authored with Jacob Mundy, although I guess you're the only one responsible for the updating.
No. Jacob was very much involved as well.
Oh, okay. Well, yeah, you're the one who's been given credit on this case. But how much has changed over the 11-plus years since the original book was published?
I think a number of things have shifted. One is that, of course, the U.S. recognition. That's a huge, huge issue. The other is that after a ceasefire of 18 years, basically or almost 20 years, actually, the Polisario, the national liberation movement that was originally fought Spain and then had to turn their guns towards Morocco when they ended up taking over, had agreed to a ceasefire back in 1991 in return for a referendum on the fate of the territory. And the United Nations dispatched a peacekeeping a force named as MINURSO to oversee the referendum, repatriate the 150,000 refugees who've been in these refugee camps in Algeria since 1975, and to give the people of Western Sahara the opportunity to vote on whether they wanted independence or incorporation of Morocco. And Morocco refused to go ahead with the referendum, and the United States and France blocked the United Nations from enforcing its resolutions demanding a referendum. So after years of stalemate and ongoing Moroccan violations of the ceasefire, the Polisario resumed the armed struggle in November of 2020. Currently, the Polisario controls roughly 20-25% of the territory in the eastern deserts. The Moroccans control the coastal areas, the major cities, the phosphate mines, and the like. So the resumption of the armed struggle is a big shift as well. The other thing that's shifted is that global civil society is starting to get involved. It's become an issue. There's a campaign in Europe and elsewhere of boycott, divestment, and sanctions targeting the Moroccan occupation. Some of the nonviolent activists who've been leading the movement there, you know, have been recognized for Aminatou Haidar. She's this amazing woman. She's called the Saharan Gandhi. She won the Right Livelihood Award, the Robert F. Kennedy Human Rights Award, the Russell Train Civic Courage Award. You know, so the nonviolent resistance is getting finally getting some attention, and I think the. And the other, and indeed, the nonviolent movement there has been quite impressive. Several months before the Arab Spring erupted in Tunisia, you had a similar phenomenon of tens of thousands of Sahrawis set up a nonviolent protest camp outside of the Sahrawi capital of El Aaiun, which was brutal, violently broken up by Moroccan authorities after several weeks. I mean, many of us see this actually as the start of the Arab Spring rather than Tunisia. But I think the increase in resistance, the fact that the younger generation of Sahrawis appear to be at least as nationalistic as their parents, and it's become more of an issue. It is it's still kind of obscure here in the United States, but globally, more and more people are finally paying attention to it.
The Moroccan regime, which has been emboldened by the U.S. position, insists that independence is completely off the table and is at most willing to offer a limited degree of autonomy under Moroccan rule. What would that look like?
It's pretty vague. It certainly doesn't meet the international definition of autonomy. And the fact that Morocco is such a centralized state that has allowed for very little dissent, as you noted at the outset, it was one of the worst human rights records in the world. I mean, I've been to 85 countries, including Iraq under Saddam and Indonesia under Suharto, and I've never seen a worse police state than Western Sahara. So, really? You know, I really question whether there'd be much this autonomy would mean much. I mean, the U.S. position has basically been we support the peace process. And it's the same line we've sort of been giving on Israel and Palestine all these years, you know, basically blocking the United Nations, you know, from doing anything, discouraging civil society, you know, activism, you know, condemning any kind of armed resistance as terrorism and say, let's just trust the peace process, even when the Israeli government has been clear they will not allow for a viable independent Palestinian state. And similarly, we see this regarding Morocco and Western Sahara, the mantra repeated just recently by Secretary of State Blinken is that we support the peace process moving forward. Even when the Moroccan government, you know, has ruled out independence altogether, and the United States has made clear that we will block any effort to force the Moroccans to compromise in any way, shape, or form. It just allows the Moroccans to continue colonizing the Western Sahara. Indeed, it dwarfs the Israeli settlement policy, and that at this point, Moroccans outnumber the remaining indigenous Sahrawi population by 3-1.
In fact, if there were a vote, wouldn't there be concerns about who actually could vote since all of these Moroccans have moved into the area?
Well, that's part of the reason the referendum never went forward, because Morocco kept insisting on including these illegal settlers. And the Sahrawis, of course, were insistent that only be people who were indeed indigenous to the territory and their descendants.
Hasn't President Biden made claims of prioritizing human rights in his foreign policy?
Of course.
And so what happens when people in Congress, when there are bipartisan calls to reverse Trump's decision, how does the Biden people respond?
generally ignoring them, basically. I mean, they assume that this is an obscure enough issue that they're not going to be folks, you know, pushing for them to change. And you know, in addition, you do have a bipartisan group that has long called for self-determination, but you also have bipartisan members who support Morocco, and they've been very outspoken and taking Morocco's line, and seem to be unwilling to consider the Sahrawis' view of the situation. This has been the case for years. For example, Secretary Hillary Clinton, both as a senator and Secretary of State, was very close to the Moroccan monarchy. The government-owned phosphate company, which is stealing the wealth from Western Sahara, was the major funder of the Clinton Foundation's conference that took place in Marrakesh a few years ago, or in Casablanca, in Morocco a few years ago. And they are and generally the Moroccans have a lot of good friends in Washington. I mean, Morocco generally has a fairly favorable is looked upon favorably here in the United States, in part because it's the Arab country. Probably more Americans have been to Morocco than the other Arab country. I mean, it's such a wonderfully rich culture, a great place, and the media has always talked about how moderate and supposedly forward-looking the Moroccans are. They have a huge lobbying budget in Washington. They brought in, you know, a number of former congressmen and other people that have a lot of influence. They've really been going all out, and there's really nothing on the Sahrawi side, the Western Saharan side, to counter this.
Well, we talked about it starting really in 1975 when Spain was giving up its control of the area. But hadn't Morocco formally claimed the territory since 1957?
Yes, when Morocco finally achieved full in independence from France, there are nationalist elements which eventually won over the monarchy, which called for La Grand Maroc, Greater Morocco, which would include not just Western Sahara, but the entire country of Mauritania, much of Western Algeria, Northern Mali, a huge area. In fact, very soon after Algeria finally got independence from France after their long bloody revolution, Morocco invaded Algeria. This is in 1963, the so-called Sand War. They were eventually beaten back. But seizing Western Sahara is part of this big irredentist vision that Morocco has had for some time. Indeed, it's one reason that Algeria has become one of the major supporters of the movement for independent Western Sahara, providing a refuge for the 150,000 refugees, allowing the Polisario the effective autonomy in terms of running the camps. They provide them with arms and diplomatic support. Of course, the Moroccans go and say, oh, they're just a puppet of Algeria, you know, and indeed many mainstream strategic analysts try to put the whole conflict in geopolitical terms about these two rival powers in Northwest Africa, instead of looking at it as an issue of self-determination. But, you know, while the Polisario is very dependent on Algeria for a number of ways, they are a popular indigenous movement. Algeria actually originally supported a rival independence movement that no longer exists. And even if Algeria cut off aid tomorrow, the people of Western Sahara would still be struggling for their independence, for their freedom.
Well, is Algeria's support mainly because of its tensions with Morocco? Because hasn't Morocco won support for its position from several African governments and from most of the Muslim and world and the Arab League?
Well, Algeria, part of it is Algeria's historical rivalry with Morocco and afraid of the precedent of them being able to expand their territory by force. But, you know, if you know the history, I mean, Algeria has long been supporter of national liberation struggles, you know, from the anti-apartheid struggle in South Africa, the movements in Namibia and Palestine for independence. Despite the current government problems, corruption and authoritarianism and that kind of thing. They have generally pursued a pretty progressive foreign policy overall. So this is, you know, quite consistent with them. But as you noted, most of Arab countries, despite supporting the Palestinian struggle against occupation, have not supported the Western Saharans. They have sided with Morocco, as have the Europeans and a number of other countries. The Polisario support is primarily from sub-Saharan Africa, though there are a handful of conservative African states that support Morocco. The vast majority do support independence. Latin America, big support for the Polisario as well, and a few other countries here and there as well.
You're listening to Leonard Lopate at Large on WBAI New York 99.5 FM and streaming live at WBAI.org. Get back to my conversation with Stephen Zunis, professor of politics at the University of San Francisco. I want to let you know that anyone who signs up to become a member of WBAI during today's show with a contribution of $75 or more can receive a free copy of the book that we've been discussing on today's show, Western Sahara, War, Nationalism, and Conflict Irresolution. And you can participate in this offer by going online to give to WBAI.org or by calling 212-209-2950 during today's show. Again, that's give to WBAI.org or call 212-209-2950. And don't forget to make that $75 contribution in the name of Leonard Lopate at Large. And thank you so much. Now, Didn't James Baker draw up what is known as the Baker Plan?
Yes, this was there are several Baker plans actually that would allow for a referendum for self determination. Morocco rejected the first two, but eventually one came that would allow the indigenous Sahrawis to elect a government where they would have true autonomy for 5 years, and then open it up to a referendum on independence or integration with Morocco, in which the settlers would be allowed to vote. Now, if you count all the returning Sahrawi refugees and the Sahrawis within Western Sahara and the Moroccan settlers, there would still be a majority of Moroccan settlers. But in part because a large number of the settlers are actually from far southern Morocco, the Defia region, who are ethnically Sahrawi, even though they are Moroccan citizens, combined with the growing dissatisfaction with the Moroccan government and that the Polisario and the way they've run the refugee camps and the liberated zones have practiced a pretty reasonably good governance. I think the Moroccans were afraid that even under those circumstances, they would lose the referendum. So they rejected that as well. This is back in 2002. At that point, Baker, you know, went to the George W. Bush, whom some of your listeners may remember. Baker was the chief attorney in the whole Florida dispute, so Bush actually owed his presidency to Baker. But he ended up rejecting Baker's recommendation of pressuring the Moroccans. And not only and so Baker resigned, and Bush essentially awarded the Moroccans by granting them most favored nation, or granting them a free trade agreement, and made them a major non-NATO ally, a coveted position that only a handful of countries like Japan and Israel enjoy having. And it made very clear to the Moroccans that they could reject any proposal coming out of the United Nations or the peace process, and the United States would back them regardless.
And part of the Baker plan allowed for Morocco to keep its army in the area, retain control over all security issues during the autonomy years and during the election.
Yeah, I mean, it was very one-sided in Morocco's favor, but they objected even to the idea
enough.
Of they reject even the idea of self-determination. And so the Biden administration's insistence that the peace process can move forward with Morocco ruling out independence, with the and being emboldened by the world's major superpower recognizing their annexation. I mean, this is just ludicrous for Blinken to pretend that the peace process is working as long as the United States is giving such unconditional support to the Moroccan occupation.
Would you say that Biden's recognition of Morocco's illegal annexation of Western Sahara is a gift to Putin, who could now portray U.S. opposition to Russian claims on Ukrainian territory as simply rooted in geopolitical rivalry rather than from any principled opposition to illegal territorial expansion?
Exactly. And apologists for Putin are really milking this, obviously. Because, who are we to take leadership in the international community saying you can't expand your territory by force if the United States is recognizing Morocco's takeover of an entire country? I mean, we're not even talking about part of a country like Crimea or Donbass or whatever. We're talking about the entire country. And so, when we're dealing with autocrats like Putin with expansionist goals, it's not just military strength that is a factor. I mean, dispatching a few thousand troops to Poland is not going to do one thing or the other. But it's our moral strength that really can really make a difference, and we pretty much abandoned that through this recognition. That's why a fair number of conservatives, have actually embraced the Western Sahara cause, even though the Polisario is a somewhat leftist organization. I mean, even John Bolton supports self-determination for Western Sahara and opposes what Trump and now Biden are doing. So this is an issue that is not just an ideological one. It raises a lot of important questions, even within a realist paradigm of what U.S. policy should be.
Well, they better be careful. The Republican National Committee might throw them out of the party if they object too strongly.
Right.
I made you laugh. Okay. But has Putin actually talked about this explicitly, or is this something that we just are assuming?
I don't know if Putin himself has said that, but certainly has come up in terms of discussions on this issue. And again, it's just why countries like France, who have generally been even more supportive of Morocco than the United States, have refused to go as far as the U.S. has. Indeed, even went out of their way to make it clear that they were not following suit. I mean, I think there was hope that if Morocco recognized the takeover, there would be more countries to follow. But again, this concern about this kind of precedent, which is particularly disturbing. And I must say that the Polisario Front has done most things right. I mean, they have never engaged in terrorism, for example, not once. You know, they are much more pluralistic and politically in terms of the governance of the camps and elsewhere than we've seen in most national liberation struggles. You know, they have put most of their attention diplomatically at the United Nations, getting other countries involved, and here we are. You know, and yet we have Dianne Feinstein and other supporters of Morocco repeating the line that the Polisario is tied to ISIS and Al Qaeda, and the most recent thing they've been hearing, they're getting training from Hezbollah in urban terrorism, and Iran is backing them, and Qaddafi is back. I mean
none of that is true.
None of it's true. Not of it whatsoever. And again, this is a progressive secular nationalist movement that has completely eschewed terrorism, and they're basically, the Moroccans are just trying to find out whatever enemy. During the Cold War, of course, they were saying that Polisario was communist, and even though the Soviet Union never gave them a penny. And they've had decent relations with Cuba, but you know, they have good relations with a lot of countries. And it's quite bizarre that people who clearly know are either lying or don't know some of the basic geopolitics of the area seem to be spouting these lines. This idea that one of the big things in some of the congressional letters and others that supporters of Morocco put out is that ISIS, Al Qaeda is growing in that part of Africa. And having these refugee camps and this instability is helping them. So therefore, we need to push them to accept Moroccan control under this so-called autonomy agreement. And again, this is really nuts. You know, the Sahrawis are not inclined to that kind of Islam. As I mentioned, they practice a rather liberal interpretation of it. You have women in leadership, particularly in the nonviolent resistance, the occupied territory, but also in the camps and as well. And you know, the idea that the Polisario would have anything to do with these reactionary Salafist terrorist groups or Hezbollah or any of these other extremist groups is ludicrous. It's amazing how they come up with these things.
Well, we've been talking about the United States and Russia and France, but what about Spain? Spain, this area was a Spanish capital, colony for a very long time.
Yeah. Yes. The Spaniards, Spain was a fascist dictatorship, from the late 30s to the mid 70s, but they practiced a degree of benign neglect in Western Sahara. They were interested in the mineral wealth and whatever, and the nomads could kind of go around and do their thing. And they've had some fairly many Spanish politicians and civil society leaders and others, feel pretty bad about how things happened. Ford and Kissinger, pushed them to allow the Moroccan takeover. In fact, it's become a big cause célèbre among Spanish writers and actors and others. Javier Bardem has produced an excellent documentary on Western Sahara and goes to this annual film festival they have in the refugee camps. And I mean, in many ways in Spain, it's kind of like, Central America was to us in the 80s, or other, when you had solidarity groups at universities and various towns. And so the Spanish civil society is really engaged, but the Spanish government, even under some of the more the center left parties, has tended to you know, support Morocco, not officially, not strongly, but they're not willing to rock the boat. And the will, what they're afraid of is that Morocco has made it very clear that if Spain pushes them too hard, they're going to just open the floodgates of refugees. In fact, just a few weeks ago, when the president of the Sahrawi Arab Democratic Republic, the Western Saharan president, needed some medical treatment, Spain let him in to go to a hospital there. And in protest of that, for several days, the Moroccans allowed thousands of Moroccans and Africans and others into the two presidios. These are small Spanish holdings on the north coast of Morocco, you know, comparable to what Gibraltar is to Britain. The Spaniards have a couple of these little enclaves, you know, surrounded by Moroccan territory on the Mediterranean there near the Strait of Gibraltar, and so, you know, that what's scaring the Spaniards, indeed the Europeans as a whole, is this basic extortion that the Moroccans have said, okay, if you push us in the Western Sahara, since we're only 12 miles from Europe, in fact, we even border Europe technically, if you talked about the two presidios, you know, we're going to, again, open the floodgates, and then you're going to have to deal with all these refugees, and it's going to help the far right parties in Europe, and et cetera, et cetera, et cetera.
You're listening to Leonard Lopate at Large on WBAI New York, 99.5 FM, streaming live at WBAI.org. I'm speaking with Professor Stephen Zunis about his updated version of a book that was published originally in 2010 called Western Sahara, War, Nationalism, and Conflict Irresolution. You mentioned Henry Kissinger. Years ago when I interviewed him, I asked him about the Indonesian invasion of East Timor, and he said, well, why should we care? It's such a small country.
Yes, indeed. The Indonesian invasion of East Timor took place just 6 weeks after the Moroccan invasion of Western Sahara, and the United States did give the green light to both of these. One thing that was rather revealing was that Daniel Patrick Moynihan, who was then Ford's ambassador to the United Nations prior to him becoming a New York senator, wrote in his autobiography, in reference to both Western Sahara and East Timor, he said, this is a direct quote, "The task given to me by the State Department was to make the United Nations as ineffective as possible in dealing with these situations. I took upon this task with no inconsiderable success." While the United States joined the rest of the international community in these resolutions criticizing the invasion and calling for self-determination, calling for the withdrawal of Moroccan troops, because they pretty much had to, since it was such a blatant violation of international legal norms, that they made sure that it was under Chapter 6 rather than Chapter 7, meaning there would be no sanctions or no pressure of any kind that would actually pressure the Moroccans or the Indonesians to withdraw their occupation forces.
Well, I mentioned in introducing this, this goes against the entire post-World War II international legal order that prohibits the invasion and annexation of one country by another.
Yes, I mean, this is a really foundational principle of liberal international relations. I mean, this is not just something that, leftists who are into third world solidarity or whatever should be concerned about. This is something very basic because, this is the first time since the signing of the United Nations Charter in 1945, that the United States, has recognized the forcible takeover of an entire country by another. In fact, it's almost the only time any country has done that. And this is what, remember, this is what World War II and World War I were fought about, supposedly. And of course, we remember the Gulf War, very similar situation. You had this autocratic Arab regime that had these dubious historical claims to a small nation on its south, and they up and invaded it and annexed it. And in 1990, 91, we thought that was so terrible, not only were we imposed sanctions and pressure on Iraq, we launched a full-scale war, you know, with over 100,000 people killed because supposedly we had to stick up for this principle of international law that you cannot expand your territory by force. You can't invade other countries. And here we are now taking the opposite tack, saying, oh, yes, you can go and invade other countries, smaller countries if you want. That's okay with us. You know, go ahead. We'll support you. We'll recognize you. We'll provide you with drones and arms. You know, you're our buddy. So it's okay to get away with that. And so, you know, this is a very, very dangerous precedent because, you know, as inadequate as the international legal order is on so many levels, without it, things would be even more crazier. Countries would be invading each other all over the place. I mean, this is a very dangerous precedent. And so, when people say, "Oh, it's just a small country; there are only 500,000 people," you know, who cares? It's not just about Western Sahara, yeah. Really.
Timor was 800,000 people. The same thing. But has anybody questioned the current administration about the reports in recent months of sexual abuse, kidnapping, and torture of leading nonviolent activists by the Moroccan security forces?
I pointed out
that the Freedom House has recently ranked the situation there as second only to Syria out of some 210 nations.
Exactly. Similar Human Rights Watch, Amnesty International. I mean, they are the – it's one of the absolutely worst situations. I mean, Morocco itself is somewhat more open than some of those countries. Once you get into the occupied territory, it's awful. And these are disappearances. You know, these are extrajudicial killings. And again, women are targeted in particular, you know, because of their strong independence and role in Sahrawi society, in contrasting to Moroccan society. There's a woman under house arrest, and the Kaya family, in fact, that these two sisters, you know, who have been sexually assaulted and under siege. And
So we're more concerned about when this sort of thing happens in Afghanistan than we are.
Oh yeah, exactly. And again, it's the classic kind of double standard that we see. I mean, if you wave a Western Saharan flag, or you just sit on a couple people sit on the streets and start making chants and signs, you're immediately attacked and beaten and hauled off to prison, and yet we've had successive administrations talking about how progressive Morocco is. You know, I mean, Hillary Clinton praised their human rights record, including their record on women's rights. So, wow. You know, this is comparable to, you know, some of you may remember, you know, Reagan talking about, you know, how the human rights situation is improving in El Salvador and Guatemala and whatever, you know, while the death squads were running rampant. We have a similar situation in the occupied Western Sahara today.
Stephen Zunis is a professor of politics at the University of San Francisco and co-author with Jacob Mundy of Western Sahara, War, Nationalism, and Conflict, a resolution just recently reissued in an updated version. And it has been my great pleasure to talk with you today. Have I left anything out?
You covered the basic points. I just hope that your listeners who – presumably are those who do care about human rights and U.S. foreign policy, we'll put this on their agenda and get involved.
Well, I think it's important for us to talk about things that don't get much attention but are really important.
And thank you so much for the opportunity to bring this to folks' attention.
Thank you again. And that does bring us to the end of today's show. If you're just discovering this program and would like to hear more of our one-hour deep dive interviews, you can access any of our over 600 past shows streaming on demand at WBAI.org. We're also on iTunes, the Apple channel, and everywhere else that podcasts are available. If you'd like to write to me, my email address is leonardlopate@WBAI.org. WBAI finds itself, I'm sure you know by now, in a very difficult position because of the pandemic. So if you value the kind of informative deep dives into one subject, especially subjects that aren't getting much attention but are really important, but we devote a full hour to, we do it on this show weekdays from 1 to 2 p.m., I hope you'll go online right now to givetowbai.org. That's givetowbai.org. Or call 212-209-2950 and play a part in keeping community radio alive in New York City. It's 212-209-2950. And as I mentioned earlier, anyone who makes a contribution of $75 or more in the name of Leonard Lopate at Large right now can receive a copy of the book that we've been discussing, Western Sahara War, Nationalism, and Conflict Irresolution, by today's guest, Stephen Zunis. Please choose your giving level, but whatever level you're comfortable contributing at, the important thing is that you step up and show your support for Leonard Lopate at Large and the station that brings it to you weekdays from 1 to 2 p.m., the only station on the New York radio dial that's 100% listener supported. So why not make that call right now to 212-209-2950 or go online to givetowbai.org. And please do it right now. I hope you can join us again tomorrow when my guest will be Dr. John Abramson discussing his new book, Sickening, How Big Pharma Broke American Healthcare and How We Can Repair It. We'll see you then.
For WPFW Washington and WBAI New York, I'm Askia Muhammad. Here are some headlines. Jury selection began today in Georgia in the federal hate crimes trial for three white men convicted of killing Ahmaud Arbery as the 25-year-old black man was jogging in their neighborhood in February 2020. The federal proceeding comes 1 month after the three men were sentenced to life in prison in a separate murder trial. A jury found the trio guilty of felony murder and other charges in connection with Arbery's death. Federal prosecutors will now argue that McMichaels and Bryant violated Arbery's rights when they willfully interfered with his ability to enjoy a public road. Hundreds of people marched through the streets of Minneapolis on Saturday and Sunday to protest the police killing of Amir Locke, a 22-year-old black man. Last Wednesday, Locke was killed by officers who stormed into a downtown Minneapolis apartment under a no-knock warrant. The warrant didn't name Locke, and he wasn't a suspect in any case the police were investigating. According to CBS Minnesota, protesters want officials to fire and criminally charge the cop who fatally shot Locke, identified as Mark Hanneman. On Friday, Mayor Jacob Frey announced a moratorium on no-knock warrants in the city. The Minnesota chapter of the American Civil Liberties Union called for a statewide ban on no-knock warrants, saying that it would be, quote, an important step in addressing police abuse of power and excessive force against black people. The National Archives and Records Administration retrieved multiple White House record boxes last month that were improperly kept at twice-impeached one-term former President Donald Trump's Mar-a-Lago property, the Washington Post reported. The boxes reportedly contained important records of communication, gifts, and letters from world leaders, which, according to the Post, is a violation of the Presidential Records Act. The boxes retrieved from the Florida estate included correspondence with North Korean leader Kim Jong-un, as well as a letter from former President Obama to Trump. Pamela Moses, a black activist from Tennessee, was sentenced to 6 years in prison last week for trying to register to vote, not knowing she was ineligible due to a felony conviction. Officials erroneously told Moses that her voting rights had been restored. She is appealing the case. Moses is the founder of Black Lives Matter Memphis and a former mayoral candidate. A black woman who worked for 12 years as a receptionist at Alabama's state-run Museum of the Confederacy has filed a racial discrimination complaint with the Equal Opportunity Employment Commission, over her treatment while working there. 62-year-old Evelyn England told the Associated Press that she was often treated like a curiosity while working inside the first White House of the Confederacy, as were the various artifacts on display, such as the belongings of Jefferson Davis's family, according to The Root. In Canada, the mayor of Ottawa has declared a state of emergency, saying the city was under siege from thousands of truck drivers who have been blocking roads to protest COVID restrictions and vaccine mandates. The protests, which have now spread outside of Ottawa, have also expanded to include broader grievances against the government of Prime Minister Justin Trudeau. Organizers of the so-called Freedom Convoy have been linked to far-right and neo-Nazi movements, with some participants waving confederate